committee to order and let the record show that it's January the 20th at 1 o'clock. The agenda for today's meeting is about, as you can see on the screen, freight, rail, and ports overviews. And then also later on we'll have the Metropolitan Airports Commission do an overview also. So at this time I think we'll go ahead and get started, and Mr. Hagel, if you'd start your presentation, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Good afternoon. As the chairman stated, we're going to move next in our overview of MnDOT's divisions within the Modal Planning and Program Management Division to the Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicles, and then to a quick description of the passenger rail office.
Mr. Henkel, if I could have you and all the testifiers state your name for the record, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Henkel. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, responsible for directing the Modal Planning and Program Management Division within the department. So by way of introduction, before we get to the director, Bill Gardner, of that office, let me just give you a high-level description of what this office is responsible for within the Modal Planning and Program Management Division. The Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations Office, or as we sometimes refer in acronym form to OFCVO, manages activities that affect multimodal freight movements and the use of private rail systems for passenger rail service across the state of Minnesota. The office also administers and enforces safety and economic regulations that govern for hire and private motor carriers operating in and through the state of Minnesota. Activities the office administers include the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, another acronym MRSI that you'll hear, the Port Development Program, the Railroad Highway Grade Crossing Safety Improvement Program, as well as the Minnesota Freight Advisory Committee, another acronym what we refer to as MFAC. So with that as a quick overview, I will hand over the reins to Mr. Bill Gardner. Bill is the director of that office, and we'll dive into some of the details that you're interested in.
Thank you, Tim. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Bill Gardner, Director of the Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. I'd like to give you a broad overview of both the freight transportation system in Minnesota as well as the freight-related programs that we administer out of our office. Because this is a pretty high-level overview, if you have particular issues that you'd like to talk about in more depth, I'd be more than happy to set up a meeting to discuss those one-on-one. Minnesota, of course, has an extensive freight transportation system that uses all the modes of transportation, highway, rail, water, and air. Trucking operates on both the state and local roadway system, but heavy trucks, large trucks, there are particular types of roads that are especially important. Our farm-to-market routes, some of the regional highways, what we call 10-ton roads for local roads that are capable of carrying 80,000-pound semis. Our interregional corridor system is our set of strategic trade corridors between the major trade centers in the state. It's a subset of the state trunk highway system. And, of course, our last mile connectors, basically the roads that are approaching some of the major freight generating facilities in the state, our ports and our rail yards in particular. We have an extensive rail network. We have the eighth largest rail network in the country in terms of track miles. We're well served by four Class I railroads, as well as a number of short line railroads, which really provide critical connections to a lot of our smaller communities and our rural shippers. We're fortunate to have access to both the Mississippi River system and the Great Lakes system for commercial water navigation. About 60% of Minnesota's agricultural exports are carried down the Mississippi River. About 60% of the tonnage that's moving on Lake Superior from Minnesota is taconite, very important for bulk commodities of all types, and access to national and world markets. And, of course, businesses that have high-value products that have time-sensitive deliveries require air cargo service. As an example, DigiKey in Thief River Falls fills up at least one UPS plane per day in order to get their products to market nationally and internationally. In terms of how the freight's carried by mode, certainly trucking is the primary mode as it is around the country, but we have a relatively balanced freight transportation system because of the presence of that well-developed rail system and access to the waterway system. And even though some of these modal shares appear small, again, they're absolutely critical to certain industries to provide low-cost transportation. There is some opportunity, we think, to grow some of the non-truck modes in order to help, for example, to get trucks off of our highways and minimize some of those impacts. But really, these modal shares are determined by the overall economics of transportation. We don't see any major shifts in these modal shares anytime soon. Of course, the recession led to quite a drop in freight demand nationally. At one point, there was more than 500,000 rail cars, idle rail cars, which were parked, which you and others, and myself, may have received complaints about, parked in places that they're not normally placed. But those are going back to work. We're about at 91% of pre-recession levels in terms of the freight tonnage that's moving in this country. And recently, the federal government released figures on future freight growth. And they are expecting a 60% increase in freight tonnage from 2010 to 2040, which raises some level of concern about the capacity and the condition of today's freight transportation system to accommodate that level of growth. A fair amount of the freight that moves in the state, about two-thirds, actually originates and or terminates somewhere else. It crosses Minnesota's borders. So we actively work with our border states and provinces. We work with multi-state groups, with corridor coalitions, and with national freight groups, trying to improve the flow of freight across borders in terms of regulatory reform and operational practices, and really trying to optimize the entire national freight system. Here's a representation of freight that is flowing on a national basis that we're connected to. The red lines represent truck freight on our highways, the thickness of the lines representing the volume in terms of tonnage, the blue lines representing the inland waterway system, and the brown lines representing freight rail. You can see sort of the blob going east-west, the brown lines to the southwest of Minnesota. That's coal coming out of the Powder River Basin in Wyoming. This country is still very heavily dependent upon coal, and again, this is representative of tonnage that's moving, so significant movements there. In 2005, we completed our first ever statewide freight plan and established a set of improvements and strategies that we thought were necessary, along with our stakeholders, on improving the freight system and this statewide freight policy, which acknowledges the importance of each of the modes, but in particular the connections between modes. We're seeing more and more freight that transfers from one mode to another, so those intermodal facilities, access to international shipping containers and so forth is more and more important for our shippers. And really this is about competitive access to markets and trying to provide competitive options for the companies that are trying to move raw materials and finished products to those destinations. Last year, we worked with others in the department and other stakeholders, the railroads, and communities to develop a statewide rail plan, both freight and passenger rail plan, because they essentially use the same network. And one of the core principles that was established in that rail plan that was that any introduction of passenger rail service cannot compromise the quality and integrity of the freight rail system. In addition to that principle, you can see here a number of freight rail recommendations that deal with improving the capacity of the system to meet demand, to address bottlenecks, to introduce some of the new technology that's being mandated by the federal government in terms of train control, to prevent collisions between trains, to expand our option in terms of intermodal beyond the two big intermodal yards in the Twin Cities, to have better statewide intermodal access, and improve grade crossing safety, and other recommendations as well. Of course, the railroads, in terms of financial investment, have primary responsibility for most of these improvements. But we look for strategic public improvements as well, where we can define the public benefits of those investments, taking trucks off our roadways, creating jobs, improving air quality, and so forth. We have a very healthy dialogue with the freight industry, both carriers and shippers and others interested in freight, through the Minnesota Freight Advisory Committee, which has been around since 1997. It's really become a national model for this kind of dialogue, and it's really It's really given us great insight into the needs of the freight industry and their concerns. And you can see it represents many of the major companies, shippers, and carriers in the state of Minnesota. Our office specifically focuses in four areas. Head and shoulders above the other areas is a focus on safety for users of the system and for travelers. And we specifically focus on truck safety and safety at highway rail grade crossings, trying to reduce crashes in those areas. We have a couple of modest infrastructure investment programs, essentially economic development programs, that seek to improve rail infrastructure as well as port infrastructure. We also try to address delays in the system, particularly on our highway system, identifying truck delays, congestion in the Twin Cities, other types of delays, and again, trying to improve our intermodal connections. And finally, introducing better services for our customers. We do a number of transactions, things like truck permits and so forth, where we're trying to improve and lessen the difficulty of those, lessen the costs and difficulty of conducting those transactions, primarily through the use of web technology. So here's an overview of our commercial vehicle activities and programs. Again, the focus is primarily on safety as required by state and federal regulations. We work very closely on most of these activities with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, as well as the Minnesota State Patrol. We conduct investigations, audits, reviews, site visits to accomplish all of these. And really the focus is on to make sure that motor carriers are properly insured, that drivers are properly qualified, that vehicles are properly maintained, and that the carriers are abiding by all the required safety and hazmat regulations. We do issue a number of permits, as I mentioned, including for the big super loads. Those are the wind turbines, the wind blades, huge pieces of machinery that can't be easily broken down, sometimes approaching several hundred thousand pounds and dozens of axles. And we have to route those in special ways to avoid danger to the traveling public, as well as to our own infrastructure to protect our bridges and pavements. We are also involved in working with the patrol and trying to improve compliance with truck size and weight regulations. We don't do the actual enforcement, that's the patrol, but we do invest in our fixed weigh stations along our trunk highways, in portable scales for the patrol, and we've recently established a network of in-pavement weigh-in-motion sensors so that we can get a real-time snapshot of the actual loads that are operating over our pavements and bridges. And that helps our engineering, helps our planning of those facilities, and also helps the patrol with their enforcement strategy. Of course, the objective we have is to reduce truck crashes, and you can see the positive trend in recent years. This mirrors the national trend. We had a 27% reduction in failed crashes between 2008 and 2009. We like to think our program activities have something to do with this positive trend. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration has introduced a number of significant safety initiatives in recent years, hours of service reforms and so forth. And the motor carrier industry, the trucking association, its associations themselves have been extremely focused on safety, trying to improve seatbelt use by truck drivers, trying to reduce speeds of trucks and so forth. So it's really been a partnership effort to try to reduce truck crashes involving large or heavy trucks. We're also involved in passenger carrier safety with these three types of passenger carriers: special transportation services for the elderly and disabled, limousine providers, and for-hire providers. We're trying to achieve a 95% satisfactory safety rating across all these groups, which we have achieved the last few years. You can see that the scores are a little bit lower for the for-hire bus operators, and we think that's basically a reflection of the less frequent level of review that we do based on what's required in state statute. But overall, we think there's very good safety amongst our passenger carriers. I'd like to quickly review our rail and freight and port programs. We devote a significant amount of energy to highway rail grade crossing safety. We receive about $5 million per year in federal safety funds to deliver this program, as well as about $1 million a year in state safety funds. There are about 4,500 crossings of public roads on rail lines in the state. About one-third of those have what we call active protection, something more than crossbucks, either flashers or full gate and signal systems. So with these funds, we install new flashers. We install about 20 to 25 of the full-blown systems around the state. We also do a number of lesser improvements in terms of geometrics. We try to close crossings. Those are the safest type of crossings, no crossings, working with communities and the railroads. And probably our biggest need in this area is we have no capital replacement program for these 1,500 systems that are out there today. Last year, the legislature provided us some funds to replace six gate and signal systems. According to our asset replacement plan, we should be replacing 60 of those systems per year, assuming a 30-year life cycle. A number of these systems are approaching 30 years in age and have become functionally obsolete. We also work with the railroads developing agreements on our construction projects for our trunk highway system. And that can be something relatively minor, such as required flagging services of trains if road construction might interfere with train operations, all the way up to a potential relocation of the rail line to accommodate a construction project. The Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, I'll talk more about in just a minute. The Minnesota State Rail Bank Program has about 200 miles of abandoned rail right-of-way, which we've acquired for future transportation use. That might be the reintroduction of freight rail service at a future time. It could be for a passenger rail line, a roadway, a transmission line. Those uses are set in statute. Right now, most all of that property is used by the DNR for trail use. We do have a state rail safety inspector that was required by the legislature a couple of years ago. That's funded through an assessment on the Class 1 railroads. Our rail inspector essentially works as an agent for the Federal Railroad Administration, who perform the primary safety inspection duties and work with the railroads. Our inspector inspects track around the state. The Minnesota Port Development Assistance Program is another economic development program that I'll provide more details on in just a moment as well. And finally, we do freight planning, the state rail plan, the state freight plan. We're currently working with the Metropolitan Council on a metro freight plan for the Twin Cities, trying to identify what's needed over the next 20 to 30 years. And finally, we're involved with some local stakeholders in two rail relocation studies looking at potential relocation of freight rail out of the Kenilworth Corridor in Minneapolis, as well as out of downtown Rochester. You're probably aware of these issues. They've drawn a lot of attention, and we have very interested stakeholders in both sides of those issues. In terms of the impact of our grade crossing safety efforts, along with the railroads and others, we've had a steady decline over the past few decades, a very positive trend. In 2009, we only had three fatalities. We had many more than that years ago. Actually, last year in 2009, we had three fatalities. Last year, I'm happy to report, we only had two fatalities involving vehicles at public grade crossings in crashes with trains. We actually have more pedestrian crashes at this point. People who are illegally trespassing on private rail rights of way, using them as trails, essentially not aware of active train traffic. We've had some horrific accidents involving young people. So we've been stepping up our activities in terms of public education and outreach, going into the schools with an organization called Operation Lifesaver, try to build awareness of the dangers of doing that. The Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program has been around for about 30 years. Originally was implemented due to the significant abandonment of branch lines by the Class 1 railroads in the 70s and 80s. The program has invested over this 30-year period about $100 million in state funds. It's probably leveraged two or three times that amount of money in private and other types of public funds. It's helped to rehab about 1,300 miles of track in the state of Minnesota. The program provides loans, not grants, but loans, long-term, generally 10 years or more, no-interest loans to shippers for things like rail spurs, for rail handling equipment so they can have access to the rail system, to the railroads themselves for upgrades of track and bridge structures, and to county-based rail authorities for acquisition of rail lines and improvement of rail lines. We accept applications on a first-come, first-served basis, and we completed 11 projects last year. Let me tell you quickly about one of them. The Horizon Mills flour operation in Rush City about a year ago closed down, laid off 40 workers. The reason they did that was because the St. Croix Valley Railroad, which served them, moving their product, could no longer travel over a bridge in Pine City. The bridge was embargoed. We were able to use stimulus, federal stimulus funds, to rebuild that bridge, and the railroad was able to operate again. And the day the railroad first went back over that bridge, the flour operation rehired all the workers, and they are back in business. They could not use trucking. It just simply was not cost-effective for them. So I think that was very much of a win-win project. You can see there has been some state bonding in recent years put into the program. Even though it's a revolving loan program, because the terms of the loans are so long, the amount of payments that come in are not sufficient always to meet the new demand, the demand for new loans. And so we do need some amount of regular infusion of funds into the program. With the recession, we did have some lessening of demand for loans, but that is beginning to pick up once again. The Minnesota Port Development Assistance Program was established by the legislature in 1998, and it provides 80-20 grants to public port authorities that you can see listed here for the improvement of infrastructure. The Corps of Engineers is responsible for the lock and dam system on the Mississippi River and on the Great Lakes and on the U.S. side, and also for dredging the navigation channel. But the ports are responsible for their own infrastructure. So this, the Port Development Assistance Program really helps to supplement their own resources to do things like dock wall reconstruction, some limited dredging, improve the road access and rail access in and out of those ports. And you can see there's been an investment of about $18 million in 33 different projects over the years. And again, the state bonding that has been provided in certain years into that program. I think I may have used my time up at this point, so I'm going to stop and just summarize by saying again, most of our freight activities are focused on safety and secondarily on focusing on improving infrastructure and the mobility of freight around the state. We work very closely with the freight industry and try to identify improvements that work both for our businesses and our communities to have a successful freight transportation system. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions? Excuse me. Senator DeCree.
Thank you, Chairman Gimsey. Bill, I want to just touch base on a couple of things that that you might have touched on, but I work in the field of obtaining superload permits throughout the lower 48 states. Some of the things that we run into from time to time that are very difficult challenges to overcome are there may be a substation, an electrical substation built out in the middle of the country, as oftentimes they are, that used a rail spur to offload a very large transformer there years ago. Now when that equipment needs to be replaced, there's been obstacles put in the way. Number one, oftentimes rail spurs have been removed. So our direct line to getting something there close is now gone, oftentimes forcing us to cross bridges that may be very difficult to cross or other overpasses that we may not be able to get under. Is your department doing any work together with the electrical industry, the power industry in Minnesota, to try to watch out for those bottlenecks to avoid an impossible move? Because oftentimes those large pieces of equipment have to get there one way or another.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we work with a number of industries in trying to try to achieve these moves. And that requires, in some cases, some creativity, and it requires looking at a variety of options. One of the challenges that we run into is we do permits just for the state roads. So we are not issuing these permits on the local road system, but we try to coordinate as best we can with the local road jurisdictions and help them and help the mover overall with trying to achieve what they're trying to achieve. So I'm aware of some of what you speak of, and we just try to do the best we can. I'm not aware of specific instances of working with the electrical industry. We have our permit supervisor here today if you want more information on that particular industry, Gene Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Appreciate this. Sorry, I missed you. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chairman, Bill, could you also just explain a little bit about what, or just tell us what area in regards to freight rail needs to be improved to improve freight traffic in our state? What would be our number one, maybe our number two project to work on?
Mr. Chair, Senator, a couple of things come to mind. One would be trying to meet the standard of being able to carry 286,000-pound rail cars and achieve 25 miles per hour for our short line railroads, which is currently the industry standard. Only about one-third of the track miles in this state currently meet that industry standard. We have a rather modest program to improve that investment. Particularly bridge investments are somewhat overwhelming for the smaller railroads, and those are costly to replace, but in many cases those have to be replaced to achieve that type of standard. I think the other area that a number of folks are focusing on right now is trying to improve some of the rail congestion in the Twin Cities. There's some well-known bottlenecks in both Minneapolis and St. Paul, where a lot of freight rail traffic comes together, where planned passenger rail lines might complicate that even further. And there's a lot of folks trying to figure out how to best put all those services through the pipe. We have a number of major bridges, rail bridges, that are well over 100 years old that are going to be needing replacement at some point. So those are some of the major issues, I think.
Thank you.
Senator Gibbs.
Senator DeGrief.
Thank you, Chairman Gibbs. I just have one more comment that I'd like to make, and it has to do with our barging and our river traffic, our port system. For the committee's benefit, there are a lot of loads that come up from through the port systems that cannot be moved by rail, cannot be moved over the highways, and it is imperative that we do maintain our river traffic and that ability to move those extremely heavy loads and those extremely large loads in that way. So I would just comment on that is a vital portion for our industrial industry as well.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add right on to that, our the photo here on your last slide is from Duluth, and that's a nacelle from a wind turbine that came in through the port on a ship and now is headed out on oversized road traffic out to a western wind field. So.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Sandra.
Mr. Gardner, and you just have to understand my question is relates, and I'm from Rochester, and things like DM&E and Southern Rail Corridor and so on and so forth, and the statewide rail plan, and I wish I would have come better prepared to ask my question, but within that statewide rail plan, it seems to me that increases in rail volumes are projected at numbers which I can't remember, but every time I see them, I wonder where in the world is all this new stuff going to come from? And especially, you know, for instance, coming across southern Minnesota. I mean, if we didn't see as much grain as we'll ever see this year in those rail cars, I mean, I can't imagine those fields producing more grain. I don't know, you know, you talk about the coal fields in Wyoming and so on and so forth, but, you know, coal seems to be going nowhere fast. As you think about that number, you probably know it. Where is all that additional new rail traffic coming from?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think it's not just a question of where it's coming from, but you know where it's going to and what the demand is. We are seeing quite a shift, and certainly in terms of long distance truck trips from truck to rail due to energy prices. So there's some modal diversion that's going on there. Our communities are going to continue to grow and demand goods. Our industries are going to continue to grow. And so the forecasts are really based on the economic forecasts that drive the amount of freight that's projected to grow into the future, just both in terms of consumption, import, and export of goods.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How can I say thank you, Mr. Gardner, for the overview, and appreciate it very much. Mr. Hankel.
Mr. Chairman and members, we'll move next to the passenger rail office and a description of that particular function within the department. Just briefly, so that you know that the Minnesota Department of Transportation is also responsible for the development of an intrastate passenger rail system that serves the overall needs of this state's connection to its large regional centers, as well as a responsibility for providing a passenger rail system that serves the needs and connects to the broader national passenger rail system here in the United States. Within that charge that is located in state statutes, the department has a responsibility for everything from the planning of that system through the overall design, the construction and programming, and provision of infrastructure and services within this state. So it is a broad authority that the department has. And I'll introduce the director of that office, Daniel Crome, who will dive in a little bit deeper and talk to you about the roles, responsibilities, and what's going on in that particular area.
Mr. Crome.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Dan Crome. I'm the director of MnDOT's Passenger Rail Office. And thank you for having me here to talk about our passenger rail activities. I'll give you a brief overview of the passenger rail office. The passenger component of our state rail plan implementation activities underway, a governance and funding study that we're completing, and a real brief update on several of the key rail projects, passenger rail projects that we are involved with. Responsibility of our office really is involved with all passenger rail activities in Minnesota, planning activities. We work with a number of coalitions, local governments, and looking at the corridors. We represent Minnesota and national, regional, with coalitions and advocacy groups. We serve as a resource on passenger rail issues. We've pursued several funds during particularly the Recovery Act phases for a couple projects in the metro area. And we manage the use of state bond funds identified for passenger rail activities. Our budget is $1 million general fund biannual appropriation of a staff of myself and two other people. We received general obligation bonds in the amount of $26 million and have, with our partners that I'll talk about in a minute with a passenger rail forum, identified these funds for the various projects that are underway in Minnesota. An important component of us of implementing passenger rail service in Minnesota, it was the creation of the Intercity Passenger Rail Forum in December of 2008 by the commissioner. And really, the initial intent was to advise the commissioner on a variety of passenger rail development issues in lieu of having a adopted state rail plan, provide input as MnDOT worked in developing the first statewide passenger rail plan, advise the department on what projects to pursue federal funding during the initial two phases of Recovery Act funds, which totaled $11 billion nationally, identify a strategy to implement services identified in the plan, prioritize those projects, and then provide input on the funding and governance study, which I'll talk about also in more detail. Meets monthly, includes members of a variety of interest groups, regional railroad authorities, cities, regional planning entities, the Met Council, various corridor development groups, labor, environmental interest, and transit interest throughout the state to have a coordinated message on how these services will all integrate together. We have one corridor I work with specifically, a mayor and our council person in the city of Lake City, that isn't necessarily interested in having passenger station in his community, but he wants good transit access for those residents to the next station, so they do have access to the passenger rail network. The intent is to represent the integration of local transit services, regional corridor development plans, Met Council's 2030 transit plan, and state transportation programs and plans. Not intending to insult anybody's intelligence, but I found these next two slides are extremely helpful to help understand what we are. What we aren't is light rail. We're not limited to specific corridors, operate throughout the day, frequent headways in an urban environment. Passenger rail is not heavy rail. It's not subway service as the Washington Metro or the Chicago L, which typically are electrified, high volume, and run on a third rail that provides all its power. The passenger rail is not commuter rail. Commuter rail operates typically during peak periods, stations 7 to 10 miles apart, and is basically focused on trips to work, such as the North Star. What intercity passenger rail is what you think of as a typical Amtrak service, connecting city pairs 50 to 100 miles to 400 miles apart, through the extensive network that has been established over the years. And in terms of intercity passenger rail, there's three components: traditional rail, the Amtrak services I mentioned, the new direction on part of the Obama administration and their vision for America is the incremental improvements using existing freight infrastructure and increasing the speeds from 80 to 110 miles an hour. And then there's the true high-speed rail, speeds above 110. Typically, the capital cost for those projects are 10 times what it would be to implement 110-mile-an-hour service. You require grade separations above 124 miles an hour. It would be electrified. You can't have any freight interference or interaction. And as I mentioned, it's extremely expensive to implement that exclusive high-speed rail service. Now, moving on to the state rail plan, Bill mentioned some elements of that. It was the first statewide freight and passenger rail plan developed in Minnesota. And I'll echo what Bill says. Whatever we do in implementing a passenger rail system can't be at the expense of the freight rail network. These systems work hand in hand. We had extensive public involvement. We had over 15 public meetings, 50 meetings in general with various interest groups, received a tremendous amount of input from residents on what they saw as a need for passenger rail. We submitted our plan in February to the Federal Railroad Administration, and in July it was awarded a National Transportation Planning Excellence Award from the USDOT and American Planning Association. In terms of accomplishing passenger rail vision, we need to develop a high-speed rail service that connects Minnesota to the Midwest. And I'll come back to this first map in a few minutes. But also be part of the national passenger rail system. The red segments on that map are designated high-speed rail corridors, and the Chicago hub system is one of those important segments of our national vision. Additionally, all corridors that would serve the intrastate system connecting Minnesota's regional centers would connect through the Twin Cities through the proposed Minneapolis Transportation Interchange station at the ballpark, and through St. Paul Union Depot. This picture is a rendering of the interior of that structure when remodeling is complete. It's, as you know, it's been in the press lately with its groundbreaking the other day, and it's a jewel of a facility to be able to have in rehab as part of a multimodal network in the metro area. Right now, our implementation activities, we're involved with preparing initial planning and environmental assessments for all of the identified corridors in the plan. We're pursuing federal funding applications for projects that are in a state of readiness. And we're working to formalize agreements with our partner states, with the federal government, regional compacts, railroads, and our funding partners. This map will show you the phase one and phase two rail corridors that we're proposing in the plan. The dark blue lines are the Phase 1 corridors. The line to Duluth is known as the Northern Lights Express. The Moorhead line is a Phase 1 corridor. Reestablishing a line to Mankato and establishing a corridor to Eau Claire along with the Chicago connection are our Phase 1 corridors. The light blue lines post 2030 extend several of those corridors, Mankato down to Sioux City to Omaha, Owatonna, Albert Lea, Des Moines, St. Louis, and additionally Moorhead to Winnipeg as part of our next phase post 2030 implementation activities. Also included is a proposed greenfield, a new alignment to Rochester. Rochester's never directly been connected to the Twin Cities, and as part of our rail plan, we declare that as a regional center, it needs a direct connection to the Twin Cities metro area. It's on a completely different development path, but we're committed to moving forward with the local partners and the federal government to explore how we connect Rochester directly to the Twin Cities. As one element that came out of our state rail plan was the fact that Minnesota is not alone with other states in having a governance structure to implement a statewide rail plan. The new Federal Rail Administration language calls that for states that want to have intrastate passenger rail service need to help fund its capital and its operation. That's on top of Amtrak's national system, which is funded by Congress. And we have no formal governance structure in Minnesota or a sustainable funding source to operate passenger rail service. So the question is, what structures is necessary for us to be part of a nine-state system that I'll talk about in a minute called the Midwest Rail Initiative? What's the role of various interests, the local governments, land use, economic development, the county governments, the rail authorities have been traditionally the driver of transit projects, transportation projects in Minnesota, the role of the railroads and the various advocacy groups, and then what funding options, what's our toolbox of funding to implement a state-supported system. In terms of the governance piece, we need to have a model that is unique to Minnesota that looks at our statutory, constitutional, and regulatory issues and is tailored to our needs. What are the roles of our various partners in developing projects and funding a program? And what are our relationships to the partnering states in the Midwest Rail Initiative? The intent would be that a train could start its day in Duluth and end its day in Cleveland, Ohio, yet we have restraints on whether or not assets that are Minnesota-owned can leave the state. And to be part of a nine-state system and gain those efficiencies, some of those issues will need to be addressed, and that's just one example. Funding, the issue of matching funds to develop the system versus operation and maintenance of the system. What are the tools and strategies that are applicable to our state? What necessary legislative actions will have to take place to allow us to operate a system? And then for the projects that are underway, what is an interim funding strategy to allow us to keep moving forward in developing this network? Briefly, I'll give you a review of the status of passenger rail projects that Minnesota is involved with. The Midwest Regional Rail Initiative, Twin Cities to Milwaukee segment over the Twin Cities to Chicago corridor, the Northern Lights Express, Union Depot, Minneapolis Transportation Interchange, and then the Rochester to Twin Cities high-speed rail connection. Minnesota's been involved with this nine-state effort called the Midwest Regional Rail Initiative since 1995, and we are the lead state on the Twin Cities to Milwaukee segment of that corridor. We have bond funds to match any federal money for corridor development, and it is one of the priority corridors in our state rail plan, connecting Minnesota to the Midwest and the country, as well as our intrastate system connecting the regional centers to the metro area. This map shows the primary corridors in the Midwest Rail Initiative: Chicago, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, Cincinnati, St. Louis to Kansas City, Chicago to Iowa City, Des Moines, and then our corridor. And you see the segments are A, B, and C. A has been Illinois lead over the last 10 years. They've made upgrades and can operate some segments there at 110 miles already. The B segment is Madison to Milwaukee. That's Wisconsin DOT is in the process of deciding the future of that corridor. And then our work is looking at Milwaukee to the Twin Cities. And as we speak, we have our partners at the Federal Rail Administration in town doing a day-long workshop on narrowing down those corridor options. We're looking at 13 options to get from Milwaukee to the Twin Cities as we speak, and looking at which one is the most appropriate for the service. It envisions 6 additional round trips a day between the two cities, a travel time reduction of from the current 8 hours Empire Builder to approximately 5 to 5.5 hour travel time, and connects both Chicago to Minneapolis and St. Paul. In February, we were awarded American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds to do our Tier 1 environmental impact statement. We've concluded negotiations with the Federal Rail Administration to begin that work. We've issued an RFP. We have a consultant on board. We're negotiating a contract to conduct that work. And we've signed our cooperative agreement with the Wisconsin DOT and in the draft stages of one with the Federal Rail Administration. It's a $1.2 million study. $300,000 of it is being funded through state bond funds. $300,000 of it is coming from the state of Wisconsin, and $600,000 is coming from the Federal Rail Administration. This is a projected project timeline. I used the biggest asterisks I could find and the smallest type I could find as well. It's all subject to funding availability, negotiations with the railroads, securing the necessary federal approvals. The federal government has a very prescribed process to develop these corridors, and many times will take years to accomplish this work, even on an existing rail line. We're hoping to complete the Tier 1 documentation by mid-summer next year, depending on the willingness of our neighboring state. Wisconsin moved forward into applying for funds for the preliminary engineering and design and construction of that corridor, and extremely optimistically have service on the tracks by 2015-2016.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to try to get your comments or observations or some facts. You know, based on where the new Wisconsin governor is at in pretty much saying scratch the project, zilch, nothing's going to happen, where do we sit in our planning, and what are we looking at? I mean, what position is are you taking? And to that point, how much has been invested to date in this?
Mr. Crum.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the situation with the corridor in Wisconsin is that's one segment of 25 potential alignments between Milwaukee and the Twin Cities. It was an issue of the state not having an identified sustainable funding source for the $2 to $5 million operating subsidy that corridor would have required. And it is one of, like I said, 25 segments that we're looking at to the Twin Cities. We are working with Wisconsin DOT as we speak and doing our Tier 1 environmental work. The governor's position, the way it's been characterized to us, is he is concerned about new alignments versus investments in the current line. We're moving to get this product, our Tier 1 environmental work, identify a corridor that people in Wisconsin and Minnesota have been wanting to know for 15 years on the shelf, and we'll move forward at that point in time. That's the status of where we are with that project. As I mentioned, it's a very laborious process to get the federal approval, the environmental approval, and our Wisconsin DOT partners are at the table with us and contributing their $300,000 to the study. Now, I'd have to do research to find out how much has been invested in over the years in this effort. It's been a 15-year-long effort. I'm not sure exactly what that number is, but I'd be glad to come back with that for you.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Mr. Chairman, thank you again. Just a quick follow-up. I guess maybe from what we read, I'm not so sure that, and I could be wrong, that the message has trickled down from the governor. I mean, he was pretty
straightforward in Wisconsin, saying there will not be money going for any future design or movement of this project. And if that would be the case, are we not spinning our wheels and in this kind of a budget deficit climate into putting any more dollars into this?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there was a pause after the election till January. The new secretary is in place. The Wisconsin staff are in our building right now meeting with us, with the Federal Rail Administration, and moving this aspect of the project forward. That's all I can say right now as to the status of the project. The product will have a shelf life. We don't know. It is the federally designated corridor to the Twin Cities, and beyond that, we're doing the planning activities that our partners are still at the table with doing. Mr. Henkel.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perry, if I could add to Mr. Crome's comments a perspective from the state and from MnDOT. Number one, planning for high-speed rail as well as other modes in this state is critical. This is a pay-as-you-go program which requires that the state be in a position to garner funds when they become available, wherever they become available from. History shows that this state has not been prepared for federal funds and has not had the state funds in place to match. Planning for this system from the state's perspective is critical to ensure that we can be in a position to put these systems in place, and that planning is ongoing for that particular reason. Second, as we've looked at our system plans and followed the responsibility of the department to understand where these modes fit and what is of biggest benefit to the state, our analysis shows that these systems, including high-speed rail, are a critical component of the transportation system today and into the future, and that this particular system that Dan is talking about from Chicago to the Twin Cities is very critical to the overall success of this state in terms of its economic development and growth and serving the type of travel that's necessary in the Midwest. So I just wanted members and the senator to be aware of some of the justification that's behind the investment that's being made, as well as justification for continuing the planning work that's necessary to take us forward.
Senator Perry.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to caution that with this kind of deficit, if there is any way that the use of funds that could be either not used or appropriated elsewhere as we're trying to balance this budget, it just makes sense to me that there are things that can be put on hold for a period of time. Because if the federal funds were to become available, we don't have the money to match it to begin with. I guess that's how I look at it. That's why I question, is it really the wisest decision that we could possibly make at this point in time? Thank you.
Good question, Senator Perry. I have Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Crum, just a quick question. Could you speak to usage or ridership of lines that are already in play and predicted ridership of future lines, and then also kind of a caveat to that? If we were to get these in place, can you speak a little to maintenance costs?
Mr. Chair, Senator,
Mr. Crum.
The only line we have in place right now is the Empire Builder, which is a daily train from Seattle to Chicago and then leaves Chicago on its way back daily. Empire Builder has the highest ridership of Amtrak's entire national network. In the summertime, Amtrak adds additional cars at Union or at Midway Station for trips to and from Chicago. So it's some of the highest performing ridership of Amtrak's system. Our state rail plan looked at ridership and costs at a high level. And as you develop a project, those numbers become more refined. We show significant ridership on the corridor from Eau Claire, the corridor from Mankato, and the ridership on the Northern Lights Express is more than adequate to sustain service. Now, that being said, there is an operating cost and maintenance cost. Every 5 years, there's a cyclical investment on everything from the roadbed up on wear and tear on the facility. I don't have those numbers, but I can pull those out of the state rail plan for the system and get those to you.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Cruz.
Just a quick follow-up question, Mr. Crum. Do you know of that line that's in place, you know, and I understand you don't have the numbers for the maintenance cost, but do you have ridership numbers for that Amtrak line that's in place right now?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do. I can provide those for you. They come out monthly, and I have a yearly summary of that.
Thank you, Mr. Crum. Mr. Chair.
I think, as you can see, that there is some concern about the ongoing operations and maintenance, what we're going to have to pay for not just these particular lines, but all of our transit and ongoing costs there. So there's a high degree of interest in that. I have Senator Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your comments. I'm going to follow up on Senator Perry's questions, and we understand, I understand that it takes a long time to set up these systems, to be involved in the whole conversation about what are the best routes, how do they come about, all of the studies that need to be in place. At the same time, given the fact that we do have the budget situation that we have, given the governor of Wisconsin's statements, it would seem to me that we are asking for a little more transparency, a little more understanding of the process that you are going through in the decision tree to get to the point that you are. At some point, Mr. Chair, I would like to ask that we have the conversation again. Once we understand what this decision tree is about when we're spending money and how frequently, because should this not go forward, we should not be spending money on it. If there is a legitimate opportunity to go forward, then we still need to have the conversation about this project and what is our involvement with this project. So I would ask for a little more understanding, a little more transparency of the decision process, and I would like to ask us as a committee to review this on a fairly regular basis so that we understand what this process is and what our commitment to this project is as time goes forward.
Thank you, Senator Lilly, and we want it to be as transparent. Coming into this job, I've said very frequently, we're going to delve into these operating budgets for all of our departments and try to have as much transparency and understanding of where our money is spent, how it's going to be spent, and we will follow up on that and get that information for you. Thank you. Now I have Senator Senja.
Mr. Chair, I did not have my hand up yet.
Oh. I saw you formulating a question.
Question mark was appearing over your head.
We've got to get that. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and these are all good requests, and I would echo those. I would also, though, encourage members to take advantage of the opportunity through the Rail Transportation Forum that meets every month. In terms of transparency and open collaboration with stakeholders and partners from across the state. That's been an outstanding initiative on the part of MnDOT, something that I either attend or listen in on, interact with through technology. So even if you can't physically be there, they'll patch you in. They have done that very well and effectively. I think, Senator, a number of us have done that for the past year or so. That's very, very available to us. I think it's appropriate to have these conversations here in this committee, but also this is an opportunity for members to really see how MnDOT, and I think that's part of why MnDOT got these accolades and awards for the development of the freight and passenger rail plan, because of the process that they undertook in terms of collaboration and openness and transparency to come up with such a high quality product. I would also just say, it's not entirely clear where the governor of Wisconsin is at. I mean, they are continuing to go ahead and build the connection between Chicago and Milwaukee, and that's going to move forward. They're putting a lot of dollars on the table for that major improvement. So I think it's kind of an open question. I also think it's an open question whether or not we should have the governor of Wisconsin telling us exactly what we do in Minnesota. We are part of a 9-state consortium. That is talking about an Upper Midwest Rail Initiative. So it's not just the Twin Cities to Chicago connection that we're looking at and talking about. And we have some stuff inside the state that is of keen interest. I think Senator Senjum has spoken to it a little bit. So there's some mobility within Minnesota. There's mobility in economic development, looking to the west and the south. So just the spending, because the guy across the St. Croix River has said some things might not be the most well-advised.
Well, thank you for those comments. Wisconsin is his jurisdiction, and I think probably rightfully so, we have to be sensitive to what he sees as the future and the needs of Wisconsin. Certainly we want to take into consideration what our needs are and work as closely with him as possible to move everything forward. Senator Seba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just will reiterate what Senator Dibble said and encourage members to attend the passenger rail transportation forum meetings. I'd also just point out that it's a much larger group than just legislators or interested stakeholders from individual corridors. Something I've been impressed with there is the involvement of the freight rail lines and their real interest in seeing the development of the state rail plan, because I think it's important for members to keep in mind that although we are right now talking about the state rail plan more in context of the passenger rail, a huge component of the rail plan was also seeing how we could develop our freight lines to make businesses operate more smoothly and to make the freight lines improve to increase commerce and movement of freight throughout the state. So I think it's short-sighted to just look at this in terms of, oh, well, Wisconsin isn't doing exactly what we'd like them to do, so we should put everything on hold. I think we need to constantly be looking forward as this committee of how can we improve our freight lines, and because it's a two-for-one investment, really. One of the biggest bottlenecks in all of the country is just south of here and in St. Paul, and I don't remember the figures now, but the amount of money that it costs businesses in Minnesota to have trains stopped at the rail yard down there is really significant. So we need to continue to move forward, not only to increase commuter and passenger rail movement, but also our shipment of freight.
I have Senator DeCree.
Thank you, Chairman Gimsey. I guess I would just like to comment and ask a couple of questions. I agree that actually I think with Senator Lilly and Senator Perry that we need to really see some transparency here. I'd like to know when the decision-making points are, when the funding decisions are going to be made. If we find ourselves in a position financially this year that we have to decide between moving forward with planning a long-term project or keeping our schools funded, I know which way I'm going to choose. And what I want to do is I want to know clearly, is this all packaged into a transportation budget where it's hidden away, where we have a hard time touching it, or is this something that we can talk about separately from that?
Senator DeCree, we'll be getting into the budget, and so there will be a lot more clarity as we go through that process of discussing the budget and where all of the money is coming from and where it's going. So just give you a little hope that there is some of that going on, but your points are very well taken. But Senator Howe.
Mr. Chairman, Tim and Dan, I, of course, participated in some of these state rail forums and very active down in Red Wing as mayor about some of the issues down there. But I think it would be healthy, and if we can have another conversation on this, maybe at a later date, but to actually bring everybody up to speed about the discussions there and where we were as far as in line for designated federal funds for our lack of a state rail plan. I don't think the state rail plan really gained any traction until we were told that you're not going to be eligible for any funding. And our neighbors to the east got almost $1 billion of funding, and we rounded up to $1 million of funding. And so I think as it relates, you know, I think people need to understand how freight traffic moves, what priority passenger rail has, and if freight traffic has higher priority than passenger rail, and what an improvements in the track would mean to our freight industry and how we get freight through here and whether more loads would come through here and how we can improve the business environment. So I think it would be healthy for maybe an invitation of this committee to be brought to that state rail forum, and that might be a healthy discussion too.
Mr. Chairman.
Strangle.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's a great idea. We'll work to see if we can dedicate at least one meeting to an educational opportunity and invite all members of the Senate Transportation Committee to that forum as one opportunity for us to ensure that we have everybody with the same information here on all of the questions that you're asking, and I think that would be a great place to start. But we'd welcome the opportunity for additional opportunities here as well.
Appreciate that, Mr. Hinkle. Senator Cruz, did you have a follow-up?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hinkle, Mr. Crum, thank you for being here. I know that this is probably not an easy position to be in. I know that this is we're trying to get in an overall picture right now, some broad generalizations. So I guess my question to you would be, with all of these lines, if you had to put a percentage number on how far down this road we were to completion on these lines, what would you say that is?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we're just beginning the environmental process of this work. There's the feasibility study phase. There's alternative analysis phase. There's the environmental phase. Out of that, you'll have 15 to 30% engineering done. There's design, construction, equipment acquisition. We're at very, very first third on the Midwest corridor, and probably equally about that much on the Northern Lights Express. We're still in corridor development, not corridor service implementation.
All right. We're down to about 25 minutes left of the committee, and we would like to get the Metropolitan Airports Commission overview here. Don't want to shortchange Mitch too much there, but appreciate your testimony, and we'll look forward to having you back and further discussions in the forums as we get the invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Sencha.
Mr. Chairman, as we're changing seats here, it would seem to me at some point it would be good for this committee to get some clarity on what really is the Wisconsin position to the extent it exists today. I don't quite know how to do that, whether it's a matter of the committee doing that through a telephone conference or a more private conference, but vis-a-vis phone, but
I'm not sure.
We need to know what that is. We need clarity on this issue.
I agree with you, Senator Senjum. It's not very helpful to try to set policy based off of headlines coming out of the newspapers and press releases. Certainly want to have more definitive information about that. So we'll continue to explore and look for that and inform the committee as possible. And as I understand, the discussions are ongoing with Wisconsin even as we speak. So look forward to additional information back to the committee on that also. Thank you, Mr. Crum. Now we have the Metropolitan Airports Commission and Mr. Killian.
Chairman Gimsey, members of the Senate Transportation Committee, thank you for having us here today. It truly is to our benefit to get to come here early in the session to kind of do an overview of the agency before we start to get bills in front of us that might affect the airport system in the metropolitan area. My name is Mitch Killian. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Airports Commission, and I'm stepping in today for Jeff Hamill, who's probably done this presentation for the last 25 years because he's been the Executive Director for the Airports Commission for 28 years, and he really is sorry to not be with you today, but he's had a previous commitment out in Washington, D.C., where he serves on the Airport Cooperative Research Program. It's a FAA-established program that he's been working with for a while now, and he had a meeting already previously out there, so I'm stepping in today and will do my best. I'm particularly happy to be here in front of this committee, since 18 years ago I actually staffed this committee and was one of the staff members that sat at the table over there. So it truly is my pleasure to be here today. What I thought I would do is, I've got a bunch of slides loaded up, and I'm going to take you through like everybody else does a little bit. But for me, I'm more comfortable with telling the MAC story a little bit in a conversational format, if you don't mind. And I'm going to refer to my slides as necessary and depending on how the conversation goes, but we are going to start kind of from the basics and work forward into some of our finances and some of the actual operational statistics and what's going on our airports today. But to take you back a little bit, for some of you, you probably are very familiar with this, but typically across the United States, Airports are owned and operated by local units of government. When you think about Minnesota up in the city of St. Cloud, it's the city of St. Cloud's airport. So the policy decisions go before the city council. And that's where the actual decisions are worked on and worked out and actually hammered out, and the decisions come out of the city council. If you think of Brainerd, it's a joint venture between the city of Brainerd and Crow Wing County. So it's a joint venture, county and city venture. That's what happens across the United States for the most part. City of Chicago still controls and operates their airport. So they got advisory commissions and all kinds of things that feed up, but the city council is making those decisions. If you go to Miami, it's Miami-Dade County. Los Angeles is Los Angeles County. So it's county boards making those decisions. Well, we had a very similar situation back in 1943 happening here in Minnesota with the city of St. Paul operating an airport and the city of Minneapolis operating an airport, Ramsey County and Hennepin County also being involved, and them actually competing with very expensive and important infrastructure. And the state legislature in 1943 stepped in and said, we're not going to do it this way. We're going to have a state agency set up that operates the Metropolitan Airports system. At that time, it was all about the international airport, the one big airport, but has since added the six general aviation airports into the system. And they said, we're going to have a coordinated effort with one state agency that focuses on them. There are others like us around. There's more airport authorities around now today. For instance, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey operates their airport systems. And there is a movement towards it. But you can imagine in this difficult political environment, if it was one city's airport to take it away and things, it would be a lot harder. So we had some very forward thinkers, and truly, I can't say enough about how it's been a model across the country. We have other states, other local governments come in and study us and take a look at it. In fact, there's some airport textbooks that don't cite Minneapolis, but cite the structure that 1943 legislature put in place to operate the airport system as a better way to focus on what's good for aviation while still, it's actually in statute, trying to minimize the environmental impacts that come from an airport system. So some forward thinkers back then. The board makeup and who's on the board has changed slightly over the years, but I'll jump right to today's makeup of the board. The board is actually a 15-member commission. 13 of the members are appointed by the governor. The one member, the chairman, is at large from any place in the state and serves at the pleasure of the governor. The other 12 that are appointed by the governor, 8 of them come from the metropolitan area. They're actually districts from the Met Council. Districts 1 and 2 of the Met Council actually are District A of the Airports Commission. So 16 Met Council districts become 8 districts for the Airports Commission. That makes up the other 8 that are 8 others of the governors. And then there's 4 from outstate Minnesota. And the best way for me to describe it to you is they're not by geographical districts or by congressional districts. They're actually set up, and there's a technical term in statute, but I like to say it this way, in that 2 of the commissioners from outstate come from communities that have small airports, and 2 come from communities that have large airports. So you actually could have them all from one part of the state, but over history, the governors have spread them out pretty well geographically. We actually have 1 right now from Marshall, 1 from Rochester, 1 from St. Cloud, and 1 from Duluth. And that's been kind of tradition for the most part. But that's to get that outstate perspective to the board. The other 2 members to round out the board, the Minneapolis mayor gets 1 appointee or can serve themselves, but has always appointed them, and the St. Paul mayor is the same. So that's the 15-member board. I've been with the Airports Commission for 18 years. Jeff's been there for over 30 years. And I think that we always say when we do this presentation, it's been a really good system. Governors in the past have really appointed good, solid people to come out and make these policy decisions. And I think that a little bit is by default in that there's not a lot of bacon to bring home to your district. It's not parochial issues. It's about the good of the airport. And so when people come to the table, it's about what are the right decisions that make sense for not only the metropolitan area here, but the state and really the 5-state region, since a lot of the traffic from the other states is feeding in through our airports as well. And so it really has been solid. Now, without getting myself in too much trouble, as a lot of you have been on policy boards, you always get an odd duck or something. But really, truly, I have to say, there's been really good people that come there. Today's board makeup is former city council members, lots of small business owners, employees of the Mayo Clinic, a retired 3-star general, truly solid policy makers. So that's at the board level. The Airports Commission staff is made up of about 550 employees, and I often explain it to be very similar to a city or a school board where you've got an executive director that serves the board, and below them is a staff, and the staff of about 550 people. And when you think of the Airports Commission, it's a lot like a city in that you've got a full-time maintenance crew that does grass cutting and snow removal. We've got a full-time fire department and full-time police department. So as you can imagine, over half of our employees are unionized, like a city staff would, doing the day-to-day operations of the airport. And then it's accounts receivable and air service and reliever airport management and all the other things to make up about 550 people that are on staff. Now, to give you a little bit of a feel for how much of the airport really is of the Airports Commission, there's about 17,000 badged employees out at the airport. That's badged people that come that require a security badge. It's easy to say that there's probably another 3,000 that are right outside the fence that really work but don't require a security badge. So out of about 20,000 people that come to work at the airport every day, only 550 are Airports Commission employees. If you look around the country, you'll see some close to us, but most quite a few very similar airports of infrastructure, size, types of operation that have considerably larger number staffs. Because what we've chosen to do is to get as many of the parts of the operation outsourced or out to other companies that can run it. For instance, the people that sit in the parking booths, when you exit the parking booth, that's a contract company that helps to run our parking facilities. The janitorial services in the airport terminal are contract companies. At other airports, there's airports same size as us that have double the staff because they take a lot of that in-house. We even contract snow removal out that's outside the fence and things. So a lot of our services are already contracted out. And so we keep a very lean staff, but wherever possible, we have contracts in place with outside vendors and private companies. Let me just touch on decision-making process a little bit because that's what comes forward to the legislature a lot. Decisions that are made by the Airports Commission Board that somebody maybe has a dispute with or questions or would like to interject something into the policy. So I think it's important for you to understand a little bit about policy decisions and how they come about, and that you don't just have the MAC board, they meet, and like regular boards, they meet as committees. So every issue is going to be heard at least twice, once in a committee and then before the full MAC board. But also, staff, of course, works up issues. But over the past 10 years, we've developed advisory commissions and task force and all kinds of working groups with those most closely affected by the policy decisions that work on them. The Noise Oversight Committee for Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport is made up of users of the airport, so the airlines and freight haulers, as well as communities around the airport, along with the Airports Commission and the Federal Aviation Administration, that sit down to work on noise issues. On the reliever airports, we have RAC, the Reliever Airport Advisory Council. It's made up of tenants that are out on the reliever airport system. We have Flying Cloud Airport Advisory Commission. I think you're getting the gist of it, and that we have all kinds of working groups that kind of work these issues up depending on what the issue is. Taxi Cab Advisory Commission. Usually there's a commissioner involved, MAC staff, and other people that are most closely affected that can kind of hash out issues so they're worked out a little bit before they actually enter into the commission process. And then the commission process itself actually follows very similar to a local government unit in that we have the formal public hearing process for ordinances and things as well. So I really think it's important for you to understand our kind of our policy process that we go through before we actually reach a decision on policies. Financing of the Airports Commission. We actually operate a lot like an enterprise fund. We receive no state or federal general taxpayer dollars. It's users that use the airport pay for the operation. Airlines pay through rents of landing fees for the airfield operations cost center, but also they pay for the facilities rents, whether it's gate space or ticketing space or ramp space. They actually pay different fees. Of course, the terminal concessions and parking, rental car facilities, ground transportation vehicles, and other ways that we take in revenue to pay for the operation of the airport. The operational costs are about $250 million a year, and those costs are paid, as I said, through the users' fees. The breakdown of those users, the amount that the users pay, with parking and concessions combined, you can see it's about 46%. 34% from the airlines, and 20% from others. Now, I'm talking about the operational budget here so far. On the capital improvement side, the past 10 years have ranged from about $100 million in construction, which is what we're doing this year. I think we're doing $120 million in construction, to highs as much as $500 million a year in construction out on the airport. And a lot of that was after the dual-track planning process ended. And so 99, 2001, 2002 through 2005, we are doing as much as $500 million a year in construction. The revenue for most of our capital programs comes from a passenger facility charge, which you pay on your airline tickets every time you buy one, and the airlines actually collect that money for the airports, get a small administration fee, and then the money stays locally at this airport and helps to do capital projects. Also, net revenues from our operating revenues, and then there are two different programs that we can tap into: the federal aid program, which is airport aviation taxes on fuel, cargo, different things that collect a fund, and then the federal government redistributes that in various ways to airports to help with capital projects. And we also receive a small amount from the state airports fund to help our capital projects. Let me stop for 1 second here and make sure, because there's so much talk about jobs. I really can't emphasize this enough, that when you think about the airport, most of the time people think about the ticket agents, the baggage handlers, the pilot base, the flight attendant base, and those jobs that are at the airport. But when you see that number of $100 million a year in kind of a low year for construction, or $500 million a year, you have to think about those construction jobs that are out there. What the bonding bill here on a biannual basis, let's just use $1 billion as a number. Well, back in our heyday, we were doing $1 billion worth of construction out in that airport. So I think it's important, and we've had this discussion with many of the senior legislators here, that not only that, you know, the downturn in the economy, but the airport isn't doing the construction that we used to be doing out there. So you're losing out on $400 million a year, every year in construction that we were doing. So don't just think about those airport-related jobs. It's the construction jobs that make that economic engine. Normally when we do this presentation, I could give you all kinds of the economic impact study stats of $10 billion a year is a one number that's been done in economic, all the different pieces. But I like to do it simpler and then add in, besides the airport jobs, the construction jobs, it's the jobs of the small businesses and large businesses that choose to live be here in Minnesota because of the good air service that we have. We truly talk to consulting firms all the time that say, if it wasn't for the nonstop service or the good air service we have, I'd have to move my employees. And that goes for large companies as well that would actually move and not be able to be here if we didn't have the air service that we have. So there's lots of different pieces to the jobs part of the airport. A couple pieces on Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Sits on about 3,300 acres of land. It's the 12th busiest airport in North America if you consider it by airfield operations, so the number of takeoffs and landings. Another way to measure it is by the number of passengers that go through your terminal. And we're about 16th busiest in that terms. We've dropped slightly. We've had about a 15% drop in overall activity at the airport with the downturn in the economy and consolidating of airlines and things. The good news is that we're finally seeing a little bit of an uptick year over year this year, that we're seeing a little bit. Even a 15% drop with what's been happening across the United States is actually a good news story, we feel. We really have held on to most of our air service, have done very well when others have lost some, you know, 100% of their air service is gone in small communities, but even large communities that have lost 35 and 45% of their air service with the change in the economy. So we feel like we've done pretty well. There's good signs ahead, and because we see Delta and other airlines continuing to make investments in Minnesota. Delta, I think, has recently spent $5 million on different improvements just around the MSP, which is a good sign, along with our data that shows that we continue to grow and be in a good position yet. Our cost per in-plane passengers for the airlines, we actually have instead of thinking of it as a landing fee and just the overall cost for the airlines, we have a cumulative cost center for the airlines all put together divided by the number of passengers that fly through the airport, and it ends up being the overall cost for every airline passenger that goes through. We have a very low cost per in-plane passenger. Our board has taken that number very seriously in the past, all of them, to try to keep our costs low, because you don't want the airlines to have that reason for not coming to serve your community. So we're in the lower one-third of the 24 airports that are similar to us in the country. We're in the lower one-third. In fact, we're seventh. And we think that we're probably going to climb, because some of those airports that are doing better than us in the cost per plane passenger have some serious infrastructure improvements coming on, and a lot of ours are done right now, at least for the time being. So we think that we're sitting very well as far as low cost for in-plane passengers. I think that I'll do a little bit on the relievers, and then I'll make sure and leave a little bit of time for questions if you'd like. I probably should do them first, because I know the general aviation folks that are in the audience and the corporate aviation people see how valuable they are, and I can't tell you enough about how valuable they are. In fact, over half of our aircraft operations in the metropolitan area happen on our 6 general aviation airports. So if you take one of them out, and you're taking 10% of your capacity out of your system. So each of our general aviation airports plays its own important role. Airports are actually, I think I have a map in here of them. I might have skipped past it. Starting in the north, Anoka County, then Crystal Airport, Flying Cloud Airport out in Eden Prairie, Air Lake Airport down in Lakeville, St. Paul Downtown, and then Lake Elmo Airport make up our 6 general aviation airports. Each of them have their own role. They range from a 7,500-foot runway in St. Paul, where you see 3M's corporate jets that fly over the Capitol here, go nonstop to Europe, to more of our Lake Elmo and Air Lake Airport, which is primarily recreational and flight training activity, with some small businessmen using the airport as well, that really look more like a rural America airport. So we have the full range. We call them relievers because they relieve congestion at MSP, but they also relieve congestion from each other, such as aircraft storage space. We used to have more general aviation activity down at St. Paul Downtown, but a lot of that has been pushed off by the corporate-type traffic, and so Lake Elmo actually serves as a reliever more for St. Paul Downtown. So when you think of reliever, it's not just relieving congestion at MSP. They truly all have their own economic impact studies, and I could give you all kinds of stats and figures, but each of them have their own job base, their own importance to our overall system, and I'm sure that over the next 4 years of your terms, you'll be learning much more about them. Yes, 2 years, I see that, Senator Rest. Thank you. we really have a lot more to tell you, and I know that Jeff Hamill, the executive director, will want to come around and meet each of you. I brought along a handout, but to prevent you from reading it while I was talking, I saved it. What we'd like to do is we'd certainly be happy to distribute it today, but I've been staff, remember, and I know how you leave stuff on the table. So if it's okay, I'd like to bring around what I call our MAC fact sheet and distribute it, make sure we get a chance to meet your legislative assistants, and perhaps you can read it during a tax hearing or something instead. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to try out questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Killian. Are there any questions? Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really intrigued, and I don't know if you've have any kind of studies or documentation, but I'm really intrigued at your outsourcing. You were talking about how you're outsourcing, I think, snow removal and things like that. Do you have any information on any kind of savings it's helped you with? Or
Senator Perry and Chairman, we actually, right now, I don't know that we have a document that I could present to say the savings. Actually, we spend a lot yet in outside services. With a $250 million operating budget, you can imagine you still spend a lot on outside services. But we follow state guidelines and things on every time a contract comes up and everything goes out for bid. And every time that we have that in front of our board, I can tell you there's a heavy scrutiny on, are we doing it the right way? So even before it reaches the board policy decision, each one of our decisions is made separately on, is there a way to do this different? Should we bring it in-house? Would be one thing. If it's a repetitive job that you're always doing, maybe it is better to bring it in-house. So I don't have an exact piece, but there are different activities over the years where we can show that we've looked at it and said, look, it's time to just put this out of house and have it be in the private sector. I think that the best figure that I could show you is the number of employees that we have compared to number of passengers that go through our terminal. There's a statistics out there that shows how low we are in number of employees per passenger compared to other airports. Other than that, I don't have an exact figure. But I can tell you that right now we have some board members that are hot on the issue to look real hard at every one of our services to figure out if we're doing it the right way. And so I think that as we move forward, there continues to be scrutiny on that in that area.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One of the issues that's been around this region for a long time was the fact that we kind of had a fortress hub monopoly operation with Northwest Airlines, and as a result, they kind of had the lock on the whole fare structure in and out of this market. You know, the exchange benefit was, you know, direct connections and not having to fly in through other hubs. So, you know, that's good on one hand, but on the other hand, we're paying a lot for our fares, you know, but now we have Sun Country. It continues to be fairly vital and viable, and we've got Southwest offering some service. Can you tell us if our fare structure in and out of this market is starting to become a little more competitive and in line with other similar regions? That's my first question. The second question, if I can sneak it in, is when is this, do we have any idea when this, 3,300-acre site is going to be maxed out? One time there was a projection that it was going to be maxed out, and they're looking at alternatives and options short of the dual track, but, you know, looking at another runway or working more with St. Cloud and Rochester to take some more inner city traffic. So two-parter, fares, and when are we going to need more capacity?
Senator Dibble and Chairman Gimsey, on the fare structure piece, there have been studies over the past 10 years that show that we do pay a premium for the hub over the years, and the studies have varied from 10 to 25%, I think. And so I don't have any updated data exactly to show what we're paying, and there's been lots of disputes of those studies from both sides to say it's worse or it's better and things. So I'm not an expert in that area, but what we do is continuously seek additional air service. And getting Sun Country to come, Southwest to come here was a big one for us. For years we heard up here, when is Southwest going to come? When is Southwest going to come? And so Jeff Hamill worked for 10 years going down and meeting with them and things. And I wish I could say it was because of the Airports Commission, but I think it was just the market and the stars align. And us keeping our cost per and paying passenger low, and we try to do it. We have... Every air carrier is here with the exception of JetBlue. All the major, bigger carriers are here. What they traditionally do is feed their own hubs. They are not going to come in and do point-to-point service. They just feed their own hubs. So we have competitive air service on most of our routes, but oftentimes it results because you have to do a connection. And so we continuously work at it and are out there meeting with different companies and trying to do it. If we see loopholes where we think there's a market miss, we contact airlines. The big one for us would be the international service, of course, that we really need to work at. If you get more international service, you're going to get more domestic service in here to make those connections, and so it really makes sense. But, well, we continuously work at competition and try to make sure. We've never denied somebody a gate. You have facilities available. No matter what, when they call, you're going to make sure that you're ready for them, and so we do what we can on the competitive air service piece. On the maxing out of runways, for Minneapolis-St. Paul International, we recently completed our long-term comprehensive study, very similar to what communities go through, where we required through a Met Council process to update our long-term comp plan to look at what we might need in the future. And we are very confident with today's forecast that our runway capacity will get us through at least 2030. With possibilities of new technology with air traffic control, fleet mix changes, hub and spoke, exactly what happens with that, we think that we will probably go beyond 2030, but with today's forecast, we're good through 2030. The changes that are more likely to be needed are additional gate space, parking ramp space, auto rental space. It's what we call landside activities and not airside activities. We think that we're fairly well set with our runway infrastructure that we have, and as you know, we recently added a new runway, so we've got some capacity there.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Killian. We've gone long again, and to the committee, I apologize for that. Just a couple of notes. If you missed one of the handouts didn't have some of the parts to it, and we'll be sure to get those a complete packet to each one of you to make sure that you have all of those handouts. And our next meeting is January 25th, and with that, the committee is adjourned.